Accession number 16395, Real One.
General Crookenden, Real One. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Chester.
Which year was
that? A small suburb of Chester called Upton, on August the 31st, 1915.
Had your father been in the army?
My father had served from 1896 onwards in the Cheshire Regiment, the old 22nd Foot. And at the time of my birth, he was serving in Gallipoli as a brigade major in the 53rd Welsh Division. And he served throughout the Gallipoli campaign until the evacuation in January 1916.
Where did you go to school?
I went to school. My main schooling was at Wellington College, Berkshire, which in those days was a fairly military sort of school. A high proportion of the boys went on into the army, the navy, and some into the air force.
Had you already decided on an army career?
Yes, I was fortunate there. I made up my mind to be a soldier when I was 6 years old, being at that time brought up most of my first years in an army background, since my father was a serving soldier. And I never changed, really.
Now, if we can jump ahead in your career to the late 30s, I think you were in Palestine then, at the time of the Arab Revolt. Can you tell me how you came to be there and in what capacity, please?
Yes, I joined my regiment, the 2nd Battalion of the Cheshire Regiment, in September 1935. And in January of 1936, the whole battalion, part of the 5th Division, were moved to Egypt by troop ship, because at that time, Mussolini's armies were moving through the Suez Canal on their way to conquer Abyssinia. And we were told, at my low level of a second lieutenant, that the British government were fearful that the Italian armies might sidestep from the Suez Canal into Egypt, where our garrison was fairly small. So the 5th Division, more or less en bloc, were moved out to reinforce the garrison in Egypt, and amongst the reinforcements was our battalion.
How did you go from Egypt to Palestine?
Well, we served in Egypt from January till April, by which time the so-called Arab Rebellion had broken out against further Jewish settlement. And so we went up by train from Cairo to Palestine, where my battalion was given the job of railway protection. We took over armored trains which patrolled the lines, and foot patrols as well, to prevent the Arabs and guerrillas from damaging the line, blowing up trains, and generally trying to cut our British army communications.
Which area of Palestine was this in?
The battalion was split up by companies, and my particular company, C Company, were stationed in a tented camp at Haifa, and we were responsible for the railway lines running out of Haifa eastwards across Palestine to the Sea of Galilee at Samak, and southwards down as far as the main railway junction at Lida, or Lud, as the Israelis call it. Our patrols consisted of a fairly primitive armored train, a coal truck with steel plates mounted along its side, an engine, a steam engine, and a second coal truck at the back. On the sides of each truck were mounted two Lewis guns, and on the front of the leading truck were two car headlamps fed by batteries, with the light of which we watched the line ahead of us as our armored train every night crept very slowly from Haifa Station across Palestine down to Samak in the Sea of Galilee. In the two trucks were the best part of a platoon, my platoon, for example, number 10 platoon, C Company, used to do this run, Haifa-Tasumak, every other night, and another platoon would do the alternate nights. Beside the two men watching the line in the light of these car headlights, a third man had a red lamp, and as soon as he saw anything suspicious, he shoved the red light out with his right hand so the engine drivers could see it, and they slammed the wheels into reverse, and the train came to a halt. We started off initially with Arab engine drivers, and then after a few incidents of being shot at and bombs going off, they were replaced by sailors from HMS Sussex, a most amusing lot of stokers who were a great asset to our little train in its rather amusing evenings.
How much damage did you prevent, do you think?
I think we did quite a lot in preventing Arabs from laying mines on the permanent way. We were certainly shot up every now and then. I can give you one example. The first time I came under fire, by this time we had sailors with us driving the engine in place of the Arabs. And after we'd passed through the halfway mark, which was a small country station called Afule, we approached the rough country leading down to the Jordan, fairly hilly with cuttings and steep hills each side. And as we slowly, about 5 miles an hour, puffed our way down this hill, we came under fire at about 9:30 in the evening, by then time dark, of course, from Arabs on top of a cutting. They were mostly armed, as far as I could make out from the sound, with ancient muskets, and I think most of their ammunition was probably rusty nails. They made a most curious noise as they whizzed past us. We did our normal drill, or drill we'd practiced. Two men on the Lewis guns opened fire. I took a squad from the leading truck down onto the track and raced up the hills to try and catch these guerrillas. We never seemed to catch them. They were scarpered away as soon as we'd gone anywhere near them. But it was all quite exciting for a newly joined second lieutenant.
Was the track actually wrecked very often?
The track was wrecked several times. The worst crash was further down in the south with another company of my battalion, where a similar armored train was blown off the line. The engine turned upside down, down a small embankment. The driver was killed, and we had on in that particular train a Lewis gunner on the coal truck, on the tender of the engine, Lance Corporal Hultrum, an extremely nice young man, and he was killed as the tender and engine rolled over down the embankment. Up in our particular northern run, Haifa to Samak, Haifa to the Sea of Galilee, we were lucky we had no casualties. The only interesting casualty, if you can call it that, from my point of view as a very young officer, was the effect on some of my soldiers. One of the lance corporals in my platoon, in the front truck with me, was a lance corporal who was our first string welterweight boxer, and I ran the battalion boxing team. He was a man of limitless courage, great endurance, and great skill, and he won us fight after fight, team competition after team competition, he being always the last to fight first string welter, and a splendid young man in every way. The first time we were fired at, the occasion I've already described very shortly, he threw down his rifle and cowered in the corner of the truck, totally unmanned. An extraordinary sight. He was a soldier of some 3 or 4 years' service. It was, of course, his first time under fire, but so it was for all the rest of us. Once we were back in England, 9 months later, there he was back in the ring, fighting like a tiger, showing tremendous courage and endurance. It was an eye-opener to me how you can never foretell how any one man or one person will react under fire. Even the toughest sportsman can collapse.
But did he develop and change? Did he get over it?
Yes, he got over it completely. Back in England once more, as I say, back in the boxing ring, he was brave as a lion again.
But, I mean, the next time he was under fire, would he have behaved in the same way?
Well, it so happens that we didn't lay him off or didn't knock him off duties. He did his normal share of patrols. But I don't think he came under fire again that particular period, that year.
But presumably, eventually, he would do. But was there anything that his superiors could do to get
in those days, we hadn't studied battle exhaustion, or, as they called it in World War I, shell shock. And, of course, there's no question of counselling or any of these modern developments. I thought it was rather extraordinary. I didn't report it officially. The platoon thought it was a bit odd. All my extremely nice and cheerful young men out of Stockport and Liverpool. And they just thought it was rather curious, I think. But another, I must give you one more example, if I may. The first time we'd done this, we'd carried out our drill, opening fire from the truck, under cover of that fire, taking half a dozen men, racing up the hill to try and catch these Arabs. Well, when I got to the top of the embankment, which they'd been firing, and found, we saw them running away, but nobody stayed to see us off or anything. The first man with me, right with me, and urging me to carry on and chase them, was a band boy. The regimental band had been broken up to get more manpower in the rifle companies, and had been distributed around the rifle companies. And I had this band boy in my platoon. He was the scruffiest young man you've ever seen. He was always in trouble. He often had VD. He was never out of debt. He was a pain in the neck to everybody. But once we were in an active service situation, he was like a lion. He was right up there with me, first to reach the top, and eager to go on and chase these Arabs. Back in Aldershot again, 9 months later, he was once more on his old tricks. Very interesting, you can't foretell how people are going to react.
Did you think at that time that the Arab guerrillas or the Arab insurgents could achieve their objective by their tactics?
No, we had a lot of troops there. There was never any question of their succeeding in their rebellion. The Palestine police were individually a fine lot of men. Collectively, they're not very efficient. And the intelligence side was poor. The police special branch and our own army intelligence, as far as I could tell at my low level, were never very effective.
Later on, after the war, the Zionist insurgents tended to get under the skin of the British soldiers quite a bit, I think, in the 48 period. Did the Arab guerrillas in the same way get under the skin of the British soldiers, do you think?
No, we never developed for the Arab insurgent in 1936, the year I was there, any feeling of bitterness in sharp contrast to 1946, when I was there again, this time dealing with the Jewish insurgents, where we developed a considerable dislike of the Jews and their main organizations, the Haganah, as it were, the Home Guard, the Jewish Home Guard, the Irgun Zwei Loimi, the most effective of that terrorist gangs, And, of course, worst of all, the Stern Gang, who were not as straight murderers. That time, when I was back in Palestine, this time commanding a battalion, 9th Battalion, the Parachute Regiment, we lost 4 men with their feet blown off on mines. We had great difficulty in getting any intelligence at all. The Palestine police at this time were penetrated considerably by the Jewish terrorists, in particular the Irgun, and not unnaturally, a number of British policemen, police constables in the Palestine police had married Jewish girls. And intelligence generally was very poor. It was a different situation altogether. Rather than chasing gangs of armed Arabs through the hills of Palestine, this time our job consisted mainly of searching Jewish settlements for arms and for terrorists, putting Tel Aviv and other cities under a 5-day curfew. That was fascinating. And protecting, not this time the railways, but generally doing protective work, VIPs and so on, and searching for arms and dumps of all sorts. The relations with the police were much poorer than they were in 36, in so much so that when we came, for example, to the 4-day search of Tel Aviv, where I was an acting brigade commander with the whole of the south side of the city linking up with Jaffa under my control, with 4 battalions and an armored car regiment, a third as ours. Such was our distress of the police intelligence special branch that we didn't even tell the police until we'd already established our control of the city, moving in at 4:30 in the morning, establishing our control, only then informing the police.
Which year would that have been, the curfew in Tel Aviv?
1946.
Why was it so fascinating, did you say, that period?
Seeing the... In searching these Jewish settlements, it was most interesting to see the different forms of land tenure and community organization they had. Some of them were completely communist in the sense of no private ownership of anything, not even your children. If you had children, they were put into a communal nursery, and you could see them every day, but everything was taken off you in the name of the community, the settlement. You had no pay for your work. You dished out a ration of money if you wanted to go out. And then you have a different form of land tenure and community organization, more normal, right up to almost feudal types of settlement. And, of course, going in at 5:00 in the morning and searching every house, and not only every house, but every shed and yard and bit of ground, looking for arms dumps, you saw every detail of how they were organized and how they lived. And then the 4 or 5 day search of Tel Aviv in my sector, half a town, it was most interesting seeing how they operated. For example, you'd have the center of Tel Aviv, entirely a Western city, with well-to-do Jews, or Jews of all income groups, like any other Western city. But the southern sector, near the border with Jaffa town, the Arab town, you have a complete quarter of the city occupied by Yemeni Jews, dark-skinned people from the Yemen, stout-hearted Jews and all that, but totally primitive. For example, during our search, the first day of the search of Tel Aviv, in the Yemeni quarter, there was one room about as 12 foot square, perhaps 15 foot square, in which there were 17 young women all living in a heap on the floor. Yemenis were much more cheerful sort of Jew than the main mass of Tel Aviv. For example, once we'd established our control, which incidentally everybody had to be indoors in their houses all day and all night, except for 1 hour from 5 to 6, when they were allowed out to buy bread and milk. But for the 3 days, everywhere else, there's a complete curfew on all movement. And to enforce this, we had sentries on each street corner. And the Yemeni girls, the Yemeni people, I suppose, developed what they thought was very funny. As soon as they were back in their house at 6:30 onwards, and as soon as it became dark, we had several cases of a Yemeni girl rushing out, probably with a mate, another girl with her, throwing themselves down at the feet of our sentries, tearing their skirt up and shouting, "Rape, rape, rape." See, our NCOs and officers would rush out and question severely the wretched sentry, "What the hell are you doing to this girl?" and so on. And then the girls would, we soon realized it was a lake pool, so we'd kick them up the bum, send them back to their houses, while the sentry looked rather relieved. But it was all done as a sort of joke.
Do you think the Yemeni Jews were playing much part in the Zionist campaign?
No. Well, I don't know that for certain, but I reckon the Yemeni Jews were not involved to the extent of the European Jews in the terrorist organizations.
So where do you think most of the Zionist gang members came from?
Well, they were we never saw them, of course, but the Argun Zwei Loimi were, in a sense, their regular army. They were much more highly trained. They were equally vicious, but not quite so savage as the Stern Gang itself. The Stern Gang was much smaller. It was the Argun Zwei Loimi who blew up the King David Hotel. And that, again, was a thing I should never forget, because once again, because my brigadier was in England, as the senior battalion commander of the 3rd Parachute Brigade, the day blew up. I was sent up to Jerusalem with my 3 battalions. I was given a 4th battalion, Ox and Bucks, told to cordon and search the old city of Jerusalem. This again was fascinating, because we spent the whole day and the next night with no movement anywhere in the city except our people. The 4 companies of the Ox and Bucks Light Infantry, the old 52nd Light Infantry, held the ring, imposed the cordon around the old city, and my own 3 parachute battalions had the job of searching all those extraordinary houses and alleyways of the old city. And there you found cases where you go into an ancient house, probably medieval in origin, and below that would be a second house, and 1 or 2 cases below that a 3rd dwelling place down into the catacombs. Of the men who blew up the King David Hotel that morning, we only found 2. They're both badly wounded, lying in one of the Jewish schools in the old city. But one of the most moving things I saw at that time was our own sappers, the parachute squadron of the Royal Engineers, whose job it was to dig out the survivors from this huge pile of rubble, which was the wing of the King David Hotel. The thing I remember most was the chief secretary of the Palestine government, a British official, was buried beneath about 10 foot of rubble. Our sappers had located him, had got tubes down with water, hot soup and so on, and they dug for two more days, got him out, but the shock had been too much and he died 3 days later.
Did you see these 2 bombers who'd blown themselves up?
I saw the bodies. They were dead. They died of their wounds, I should have added. We knew which they were, because when they wheeled those milk churns into the nightclub below the headquarters, a passing gunner, a soldier in the Royal Artillery, had seen them running away and with his pistol had fired at them both and wounded them. But it's astonishing to, looking back, using hindsight, how we, the British, had established the main headquarters of both government and army in a wing of the King David Hotel, with immediately below it a nightclub wide open to the public. So when the Irgun Zwei Leume terrorists in the morning wheeled in three milk churns or a pack of explosive, there's no one to stop them.
So the two bombers had died from the gunshot wounds, had they?
They died from the being fired at by this gunner, yes.
Any other incidents you recollect that you were personally involved in the 46 days?
Well, there were so many. And the whole time was so interesting. I remember one personal incident was highly embarrassing. The local Arabs in Palestine, which of course there are still very large numbers living in their own villages, were extraordinarily skillful thieves. Around each army camp, and in our particular camp, was an eightfold dunnet wire ring fence patrolled by our own sentries. My tent was quite close to the wire, and one night I went to sleep, as I always did, with my pistol under my pillow, but had not obeyed my own orders that it should be tied to your person. I woke up in the morning, my pistol had gone, and every stitch of clothing in my tent. And from the tracks we could tell two Arab children had got in through the wire, in spite of the patrol, and it's very difficult at dunnet wire, and completely cleaned me out.
How do you know they were Arabs?
Because nobody else would have had the skill. And we were close to an Arab village.
I've heard some allegations that the Zionist gangs got arms from the British forces.
I left in towards the end of 1946, and my battalion stayed there till the end of the British mandate. Was it 1947 or 48? And certainly nothing like that happened in my time, because the British Army remained extremely well disciplined and with a high morale. But of course, by the end of the mandate, when we were already giving up, if you remember, though I wasn't there myself, the British Army concentrated in Haifa and in Jerusalem. The small, steadily shrinking enclave around Haifa was eventually emptied of British troops by sea, whereas the British troops around Jerusalem went down to Egypt in a long convoy.